Welcome to On Farm Trials with the PNW Farmers Network, where we explore the many trials that come along with cropping systems innovation in the inland Pacific Northwest. Plenty of questions get asked while farming across this region, and together, we're digging into what it's like to try to answer some of them as producers, researchers, and the many other professionals in the field that get things done. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland. Today, we're out here with Mr. Doug Schuster and Ms. Erin Rule out at Westfield Properties outside of St. John, Washington. Thanks so much for having me out, you guys, and really appreciate being here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Looking forward to hearing more about your on-farm trials. With that, in this father-daughter team, I'd love to hear a little bit more about yourself and your farm and how it's going farming together.
You go ahead and start.
Okay, so I'm Erin. I'm Doug's daughter. I've been farming here with my dad for about 5 years officially, but unofficially I was raised on this farm. I've grown up doing a lot of the things that I'm doing now, and I took a little hiatus in going to college and then got a job in Seattle for a couple of years, and then after that decided that I really wanted to come back and give this a shot, and so I came back in January of 2019, and have been here, you know, just helping Dad do the farm thing ever since.
We're not really an anomaly either. There's several gals, young gals, your age gals in our area that have come back to help their dad farm, so that's really cool.
Really cool.
Yeah, and yeah, she hasn't been doing it for 5 years. She's been doing it for about 26.
Not to name any names or anything.
When I first started, had her feeding calves when she was about 2.
Oh, ain't nobody got life skills like farm kids, though.
She didn't like it very much at first, but it's grown on her.
Yeah, it's now my main job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what made you come back to the farm and how it's been going.
So in high school, I was like, I'm getting the heck out of Dodge. I don't think this is for me. I want to go out and do something else with my life. So I actually went to WSU and got a degree in construction management. And that took me to Seattle, where I worked for a large general contractor for about 2.5 years. My husband and I kind of met over there and started dating, even though we also went to college together. But he's from Spokane originally, so we always kind of talked about moving back. And when the opportunity presented itself and we left Seattle, I kind of thought, you know, I want to be involved in the farm in some capacity because I don't want to see it. At that point, my parents had started talking about like what their future retirement might look like if neither one of us came back to the farm. And I was like, God, I don't want to lose this. You know, it's such an important part of my childhood and I want it to be there for my future kids. And so I thought, well, here's an opening in my career where I don't have a job lined out. And so why don't I just go back and try it? And if it's horrible and I don't like it, I still have, you know, other opportunities to get a job. And if it is for me, then I gave it a shot. So with that, we moved back here and I started working on the farm full time. And I think it's been going great. Do you think it's been going great?
I think it's been going just fine. It was funny when they were in Seattle, they kind of said, well, we got this 1 year plan where we're going to bail on this Seattle idea and we're going to come over there. Marshall's family's in Spokane, and they'd come to all the Cougar football games over that wretched pass, you know. But they said, we're going to, about a year, we're going to come back, and, you know, and we're going to figure something out. And then about 2 weeks later, they said, maybe more like 6 months. It's happening kind of quickly over here. Another week goes by, and they said, we're going to be there in less than a month. So, and it's like, what are you going to do for housing? What are you going to, you know, there were so many things that were just off the cuff. But yeah, right from the get-go, she was working with me on the farm. So that was her job as Marshall took a different job in Spokane. So, and there's lots of things she can still learn. A lot of shop work we started out with and got her hands dirty building a 350 Chevy engine, first thing. So
Got some mad respect for the fabrication aspect of farming. All the banging on metal.
It's definitely not my strong suit.
But you're learning.
It's good. I mean, there's so many different skill sets that, you know, you get to grow in. And it's nice that you are part of the legacy and so that you have grown up with this. And it is really exciting to, you know, not just be able to visit with a, you know, next generation farmer that is up and coming. It's fun to see some more lady farmers and have some more lady farmers or farmers, as I've had other guests on the podcast talk about. Now, Mr. Schuster, would you share a little bit more about how you came to farm, a bit more of that previous generation farm legacy and a bit about the farm itself?
I'll try to keep it somewhat short, although I could go on for hours on that. I started here working for my uncle in 1979, and I didn't know it at the time, but my uncle was none too pleased to have to babysit his older brother's kid. And, I mean, he put me right on the hard stuff right away, digging fence posts, picking up rocks, you know, anything to try and break me. And I loved it. I mean, it was years before he even let me drive a tractor, you know.
That's really how you get someone hooked, isn't it? Have them pick rocks right out of the gate.
Oh, boy.
Or you haven't lived until you've picked rocks.
It used to be your punishment. It still can be, you know. But, you know, let's see. I went to WSU as well. My dad really wanted all of us kids to get a four-year education. He's an alum as well. So even though I was really focused on this, he said, you go get your dang degree, and then, you know, you can do what you want. And so after 4 years, it was about 3 years in, my uncle picked up some new ground. And he said, what's your plan after college? And I said, well, probably get a job, you know, in irrigation or something. He said, well, I got some new ground. I could use the help right away. And I said, done. So right after college, I moved here. And they had a little house for me to stay in. And there's not a lot of pickings around here. So I went to Portland and found myself a nice wife.
Aw, well, that's good. I mean, she looks like she's still around. So you've done well.
Yeah, 35 years.
And so is she a big part of the farm as well?
Yeah, she has been in the past. I mean, here more recently, obviously, was taking care of the baby and everything. But she's done it all. She's picked up hay. She's helped with fence. She loves chasing cattle. That's her favorite thing. Yeah, but anytime you got to have bodies, she's always available, you know. Yeah, she's done it all. She's driven harvest truck and, you know, all the things you would expect. But
takes the whole family. And it's also really important to make sure that somebody awesome is taking care of the babies so that mom can go out and farm.
Yeah, that's so really working very well right now.
It really sounds like you guys have a great family team making it work here. Mm-hmm. With that, would you share a little bit more about your farming conditions out here in St. John, your soils, your climate, your kind of standard crop rotation, that sort of thing?
We're right on the edge of the channeled scab here. I mean, the road you came in on is one side is farm ground, the other side is rock. So we do have too many cows because we're right here next to the rock and you can't do anything else with it. So as those pieces have become available, we've gotten the lease on them. But the rainfall here can be around 16 inches, I would say. A lot of the hills here where, you know, they've eroded away because of the great flood are rather steep and fairly difficult to manage. But it's fairly good soil. It's better than, you know, the lighter soil down in Ritzville, Ewan, you know, further that way. Not as good as north up by Plaza, Spangle, and things like that. But we have sometimes you can call it like an 8-year rotation, more appropriately maybe a 4-year rotation with the winter wheat, then spring barley, until both girls won't let me plant that anymore because they hate it.
Well, when you cut it, it's only 6 inches tall. I don't really appreciate it.
No. But we go winter wheat, spring barley, then spring wheat, and then we'll either do chem follow or canola is what we've been working on for the last 5 years or so.
Nice. And you said you've grown some peas in the past before, too?
I did in the past, yeah. My uncle dabbled in peas and lentils and stuff. We've never done garbanzos. Haven't just had, I'm afraid. You know, but dad, uncle did peas and lentils, and once again, just extremely difficult. They have got much better equipment now for cutting that sort of thing. But canola's, it seems like a good moneymaker. I really, really like what it does underground in the soil. And it's really easy to no-till back into winter wheat. So,
When you talk about those underground effects, what have you seen?
Well, you know, we're building soil literally with putting that much organic matter in the ground via root structure. And those types of things you can't see overnight. You know, it takes years and years and years to see results. But, you know, we've been doing that and some other interesting things as far as, you know, growing organic matter or, you know, redistributing organic matter.
Ooh, can't wait to hear more.
But it takes years and years and years. So I can see it from the combine cab. You know, when you get on one of those Henry Hilltops and in years past you were eating half barley and half dirt. And then one year you're like, wait a minute, my header's not in the dirt and I'm clipping off all the heads. This is working, you know. So it's growing better crops on those marginal pieces.
Nice. Well, that seems like that's a good segue into what are some of your management goals as you're thinking about, you know, trying things on the farm? What sorts of goals are you working toward?
We're trying to make money every year, as Dad has said in the past. But we're also trying to do more with less inputs. We're trying to improve the quality of the soil year over year. Basically trying to just leave things in better shape over time than they were when we started.
So when your daughter grows up to want to be a farmer like her mom, she's got some great soil to take on.
That would be ideal. Yes.
Awesome. Did you want to add anything to that, Doug?
The goal is to try and leave it better than when you first got here. We had to do that in Boy Scouts when we went camping. You know, you made sure to left an area better than when you got there. And that's what you want to do in farming. We, back then, me and my uncle both chose not to do CRP. A lot of the neighbors have capped off the hilltops and they just don't farm them anymore because they don't produce. So you put them in the CRP program and get a payment for growing grass. But we bowed our neck and said, we're not going to do that. So my hills are still all in crop. So how do you make those hills do better is the big focus.
So with that, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the experiments and trials you currently have going on the farm?
I can do that. Yeah, I wrote down a little note here because one of the questions in all this is, how did you come up with this idea to do this? And it had, I don't know how many years ago, a piece of ground up the road we used to farm. And we had a big hay barn right next to it. And we were getting down to the end of the hay. And my uncle said, you know, that's just crap hay there. They're broken bales. You know, there's nothing we can do about them. Why don't you put those on a trailer and run them up here on this hill, just a really ornery little hill, just 50 yards away from the barn, and just kind of flake it out a little bit so we can get through it with the rod weeders or whatever we were using. And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And I didn't think anything of it until we were harvesting the winter wheat. And it was in standard fallow, you know, so we kind of mowed those piles around a little bit with the rod weeder. And he got through it with the seeder. And the next year, it looked like a cow had gone up there and pooped. Because here's these little tufts of wheat that's a foot taller than all the rest. And I'm like, what is that? You know, well, it was the hay bales just decomposing and providing organic matter or water holding capacity for the wheat plant. And it was really amazing the difference in the size of the plant. I can't speak to whether it yielded more, but it sure looked better. And the more organic matter you grow, the more you have. So when you're growing a crappy crop up on top of the hill, you're not getting back a lot of organic matter. So the more you grow, the more you get. So, and then from then, I don't know, I got this wild idea one time that why do we have, you know, all this residue in the bottoms where the wheat does really well? We don't really need it. Our organic matter down there is a good number. It always does well. So we were into the hay business and whatnot, so we decided we would rake up, because we mow our stubble with a Schulte, we decided we would rake that into a windrow and try to pick it up with a big baler. They picked it up just fine. Made nice little wheat straw bales that are already kind of processed, You know, they're not long straw. So they were ready to decompose. And then I borrowed a manure spreader from a neighbor. It would just hold one bale, just one big bale, set right down in there, pull the strings off, take off up on top of one of the hills that I wanted to redistribute the residue, and I just flinged it out. And like my first time, I was like patting myself on the back, and then a week or so later, a big wind came and took all that residue and took it right over to the other side of the hill. I was like, well, dang, that's not where I wanted it. You know, so here you've got this major problem now because you can't get through it with anything. So I learned quickly that if you're going to, you know, fluff out a foot of straw stuff on top of a hill, you need to pin it down. So we use a chisel to stick it to the dirt so when the wind blows, it doesn't blow away.
Hey, that sounds like a good lesson learned.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that one out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So did you stop at straw with that? Or, you know, rumor has it that you might not have.
No, we didn't stop at straw. I wanted to do more and more of it after that first year, and I couldn't really see that many results because there is a nitrogen tie-up in the straw. And obviously our following crop is barley. You know, so I knew I wouldn't really see a result there, but I thought it was a really good idea and I wanted to do more. So I found out that Bartek has a bigger spreader. And so I went and talked to those guys and they said, yeah, you can rent our spreader. And it was twice the size of the one that I had. You could still pull it with a small tractor and you could put 1.5 bales in it, maybe 2. And so I did it again. And then Scott at Bartek the next year, he says, hey, I got a better idea. Why don't you buy our product?
There's a good salesman.
Yeah. Oh, he's like, why don't you buy our product and put it through our spreader? And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I like what I'm doing. And he said, oh, I guarantee you, you're going to get more results. You know, he's selling. And then he offered me to have the spreader for free if I bought X number of tons of product. And did that year. And we just kept getting, liked it, did more and more. And eventually got their biggest spreader, which holds 16 tons of material. So you have to pull it with a big, big tractor. And we were, about that time, Erin's coming back, and she's super excited about the compost idea. You know, what a great way to get rid of excess material. And so I kind of put her onto the job, and we were doing the videos then, and she was really having a good time teaching, you know, what we're doing. And then one day when we were in some bad conditions, she went for a hell of a ride off a hill with 40,000-pound tractor and a 40,000-pound spreader.
Because remember, we're putting this on the Andreas hilltops, so
yeah,
it's not exactly easy to navigate.
Yeah.
Well, and you guys really do have some of like the Palouse-iest of Palouse hills out here.
Thank you. Is that a word?
I don't know if that's a word, but we're making it one today.
I'll take it. Yeah. So that was fun. Not.
Yeah, no, not that's fun.
I feel like there's a certain amount of evil Knievel farming that just happens in this area. So I'm sorry that that's now part of your legacy too.
There's definitely an element of, am I going to make this? Did I make a bad call here?
Yeah.
When you're driving around on the hills, but you learn some good lessons occasionally.
Yeah.
I forgot. I've got a couple of stories from the research tractor too, but we'll save those for another time.
Yeah, and if you want to keep your daughter driving the tractor, you can't let it scare the pants off her, you know, because then it's like, I don't want to do that anymore. That was scary. So you got to find something that she's comfortable with, and, you know, you got to get back on the horse, but that was not a fun ride.
Oh, survival instincts. But it sounds like you were happy that you listened to Scott at Bartek. What have you seen since you've undertaken? Like, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the rates and some of the outcomes that you've seen on your farm?
Yeah, we're trying for 20 tons per acre, which, you know, when I tell other people that, and then you realize the stuff can cost as much as $20 a ton. So on a per acre basis, you're putting down $400 an acre on your worst ground. You know, people are like, you're crazy. But in a 100-acre field, you're probably only going to do 5. You know, you pick your most eroded on knobs and your, you know, your worst pieces, and you just isolate those little spots. So it's not a huge cash outlay. And once again, you always got to be very mindful of the fact that this is not going to give you a return on investment in 1 year. You know, it's going to take years And so we're going to continue to do those spots. And, you know, either with that or now we've kind of segued into the cover crop thing in those same areas, trying to grow the organic matter, you know, underground with a seed rather than sprinkling it on top.
Well, now that stuff will grow up there.
Yeah, I mean, it grows. I mean, and it's just really hard to quantify other than just know what it was before. You know, I've been here since 1979, and there were times, you know, he would almost not even want to cut those places. It's hard on equipment. There's nothing there. He's like, oh, they're going to just skip that, except for there's seeds there. And then seeds become weeds if they don't go in the bulk tank. Mm-hmm. So then you got this hellacious mess of volunteer barley or whatever, and you're thinking, I didn't think there was a single seed in one of those heads.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do that. You want to try and shave it all off as best you can.
And now what have you seen as the result? It sounds like maybe one of the things you're looking for is a bit more evenness across the field and year to year. Do you want to talk a bit more about that too?
The goal is to like improve the yield across the field, right? And the areas that there is definitely a margin to do so is where the yields are not great to begin with. I mean, there's not as much improvement that you can have in the areas that are the draws and the good ground because that soil is already doing pretty much as good as it's going to be able to do. But obviously there's a lot of room for improvement where you have shallow soils, where you're not growing a lot of crops, you have less water holding capacity. So if you can improve the soils in those areas, then you can increase the margin of yield by a substantial amount and then therefore increase the yield overall across the whole field. So,
and you've been seeing that with these efforts, it sounds like.
I think so. Yeah, we've gone through obviously some very good years and some fairly poor years. Last year wasn't very good. I mean, it never rained, but you know, more or less across the whole farm, I didn't feel like we got taken to the woodshed on our yields just overall. Sorry.
Very scientific quantification here.
Well, they were pretty good, you know, considering the year. I was pretty happy with them. I mean, we had some really fairly good winter wheat on chem fallow, and the winter wheat on canola ground was adequate, in my opinion, considering the year. So, and that's, you know, sometimes years like that, you just got to get them behind you, you know, and hope for a better year. That's what we do every year.
Well, I think there's something to be said, though, theoretically, for the increased resilience. You know, if you have more organic matter in the soil, theory is that you really maximize whatever moisture you possibly have and turn that into the crop.
Yeah. Then a side benefit is those ornery places around here, all they grow is Russian thistles, you know, because you got no competition. Mm-hmm. So if you can grow a decent-sized plant up there, and there are better chemicals and whatnot, but just plant competition is the best for keeping weeds away.
How is it that you decide to try something again?
It speaks to just this like innate knowledge. I mean, you've been working with the land for 40 some years, right? Yeah. And so you just have an innate knowledge of what it looked like when you started and what it looks like now. And you maybe don't have any like data to say that it's improved, but you just know that it's better because you've seen results year over year.
Well, or just the, like when you say, I can just see it from my combine.
Mm-hmm. That's all I can tell you. I mean, I'm going to be working on getting the yield monitors or whatnot, but at least in the combine that I have a monitor in, the data just, it's so obvious. You know, I'm like, I know the draws are better. I know that hillside had too many wild oats or something. You know, I know these things sitting in the seat. And now you've shown me on the screen, but my little areas are so small that I just don't know that we're going to see it. Maybe. I mean, I think a real better test for it is that field in general doing better over the course of 20 years, mm-hmm. even in a drought year.
I think that's interesting to kind of how much is it buffered from the lows. That's a really interesting metric that doesn't come up often in conversations about ROI.
Well, and I think Aaron brought up a really good point about the different soils. I mean, the draws are going to do what the draws do. They're just going to yield. Mm-hmm. You know, year in and year out, there's going to be better moisture, better organic matter, better soil. And you can't really change that. I mean, you can go from 100 to 105, but if you can take a 20 bushel hill and take it to 40, all of a sudden, then you're bringing up that average rapidly, even if it's only 5, 6, or 10 acres.
As you're talking, I'm curious, have you done anything with the ground kind of in between? Because you talk about your really good ground and, you know, these hilltops. Are there gains to be made in the ground in between?
Possibly, but that. I mean, that's the super steep stuff. Yeah. I mean,
I think that's the hardest stuff to like get something to grow on. I will say that, so we started with this residue redistribution, then we moved into like a little residue redistribution and some compost sprinkled up there. And then we kind of moved into cover crop, and you can plant cover crop on your steep side hills and the tops of the hills. Really hard, speaking from personal experience, when you go sliding down the hill to get the compost and the residue distributed on the steep stuff. But you can stick a drill in the ground and put some cover crop there. And so that would probably be the best way that we found to address the ground in the middle. And then otherwise you're just, you know, erosion is going to continue to happen no matter what you do. So you're hoping that there's a trickle down effect with the soil that you're building on top of the hill.
Well, there's so many different carbon fractions. My brain just started kind of, oh, I wonder how those are moving. I'm sure somebody's got data on that somewhere. Maybe the Cook Farm. Anyway, that's really interesting. So now I got to ask, what's your favorite cover crop? Do you have a single cover crop? Do you mix it?
Can you answer that, or do you want me to?
I don't know that I have a favorite one. I have ideas of like stuff that I want to do with cover crops that we've started trying to do, but my focus has kind of been more on like improving pasture and like trying to get better grass to grow in marginal areas of the pasture so that we can like have better hay or there's more food for the cows. So that's kind of where I want to like trying to be incorporating cover crop and like seeing what we can do there. But as far as like what you've done on the hilltops and stuff, like I think you should speak to that.
Probably my favorite is the tillage radish, just because of the size and depth of the root. When I started growing canola, I thought, this is going to be great. It's got a good tap root. But I'd go out there and pull up an adult plant, and it just hits this pan. So instead of this, yeah, it grows laterally. But you don't really see that as much with the tillage radish on those hard hilltops. It really seems to get down there better than canola. And canola is good, but... And it's hardy. It grows big. I think it's a good pollinator. You know, I don't really have a whole lot of opinion on that. But and it, you know, outcompetes weeds and
probably makes a little more money than the tillage radish, though.
Oh, the canola does. Yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, that's canola is a cover crop. Let's just get that done. It's one of the best.
Oh, did you eat the tillage radish?
I'm sure I've sampled it. Yeah.
We grew some Mondo ones in a really wet flat.
Yeah, when you put
taken them to the county fair.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe carved something out of it, like a weird little face.
They were big. And in that flat, we also had the turnips that year.
Yes.
The thing that I'm not really hugely fond of those is they tend to be on top of the ground. And when I seeded that field to winter wheat after cover crop, and it was in a very wet zone, I was using it as a mop. Instead of, you know, I'm like, how can I dry this out? Mm-hmm. You know, and I've heard other people talk about that. But in the fall, I went to seed it, and it was just stink. Oh, my God. You know, everything's rotting, and I'm running over all this stuff. And a neighbor came by, and he says, what the hell are you doing? I said, I'm seeding. And I looked back, and I said, actually, it looks like I'm making salad. Because my drill was just cutting those darn turnips right in half, you know. But there was plenty of moisture because it's a wet flat that wouldn't dry out. So the only place that the wheat was compromised was where it drowned. You know, the next year the wheat was fantastic, but in those areas where it flooded out again, it wasn't good. So there's no harm in doing a cover crop or canola or anything else where you have unlimited moisture.
Oh, it's fun, the different purposes that you're exploring cover crops for on your farm. From what I understand, you guys are participating in the University of Idaho's PNW Cover Crops project to make the decision aid support as well. Do you want to just talk briefly about your participation in that? I definitely want to hear what your grower's choice treatment is.
I thought it was very educational, actually. Every time they were there, I wanted to go down and pick their brain. So it was really nice that they would contact me and say, hey, we're going to be there. You know, sometimes it didn't work out, but I want to know what they're doing. The replicated plot thing was well thought out. I think we learned something. You know, they're trying to figure out when is the right time to terminate to. It's a crop insurance question. So that's where they're trying to, I think, base their whole thesis on, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there were some questions on that, but I thought the stand came up good all around, even though it was very late seeded, because I can't really get myself to do an experiment before I get my money crops in the ground.
So that makes
they
sense.
They were totally fine with that, but my favorite mix is a good question. It's kind of morphed a little bit, you might say. Sometimes it just got some extra seeds laying around. It's like, hey, throw this in the cover crop, you know? So I had a couple of buckets of an old barley pea mix that I'd grown years ago, and the mice were eating it away, and I thought I might as well just chuck that in the ground in my grower choice one. And then I...
That does sound very scientific.
It does. But then I also... Years back, I used to blend canola with a little product that hung around for just a short time called Compel. It's a compost pellet. And so I used it in canola as a bulking agent so I could get my seed rate down where I thought it needed to be. It's very difficult with John Deere drills to open it up to the width of a dime and then pray. But I had a little bit of that stuff left over, and I had mistakenly one time, now that I can seed without a bulking agent, threw it in my drills, and it ended up plugging the seed cups, and I had kind of a mess back there, fortunately, or nobody could see it. But I had these bags left over, and I thought, well, let's throw that in the cover crop. So I'm not sure that they necessarily appreciated that, because when you terminate a cover crop with Roundup and it's got Roundup Ready canola in it, it doesn't terminate. So It was interesting to look at from the air or top of the hill, where, you know, going through my stuff, it killed the other. It killed the barley. It killed the peas. Killed, you know, but that canola just kept growing.
That's interesting, though. I mean, how did you evaluate that crop, or how would you evaluate that crop? Is there something to be learned from that?
Well, when I did the cover crop thing up here on top of the hills, I sprinkled in some of that. And that was in a special blend that I got from Clearwater Seed. Just had four things in it. I don't really care to have 10. But I did have some Roundup Ready canola in that. And the nice thing, I guess, the nice thing about doing it on hilltops is I noticed no need to terminate. It self-terminated. I mean, the canola got up to about 2 feet high, and the tillage radishes were about the same, and everything else just kind of petered out. So I didn't have to spray it. I didn't have to mow it to seed it. And so, you know, then I got a little bit more brave with seeding into growing canola with my drill, which is one thing that Tracy wanted me to do, to seed into something that's 3 or 4 feet tall. And it makes a guy a little nervous when next year's your money crop. You only get one shot. You don't want to screw it up.
Wait, okay. So your neighbors with Tracy Erickson,
yes,
who's definitely been one of our pioneering innovators in the region. So what was he trying to get you to try?
When I did that water mop, that was my first segue into cover crop. And that was just the tillage radish and the turnips. And he came up and thought it looked fantastic. And then when I came up harvest time, approximately, I was like, oh my God, it's 6 feet tall.
Did you invite him over to have some salad?
He didn't come by while I was seeding. But, well, because he was mad, because, you know, I looked at it and I said, oh my God, you know, I just seeded 8 pounds per acre and I'm about to put 8,000 pounds of seed on the ground. How am I going to take care of that? You know, so I mowed it with my Schulte. And that worked the crap out of the tractor. Let me tell you what. It was hard. It was only like 20 acres, but it took forever. And we actually mowed it twice because it just kind of laid it down. Then we went back the other way to cut it off at a reasonable. And then it grew back again. You know, grew back about 2 feet tall. That's like,
now, do you guys ever put your cows out on this stuff?
It would have been a good spot, but we're still very nervous about bloat. I mean, we don't understand the bloat thing good enough to risk just having a bunch of legs up cows out there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've been curious about with the integrated grazing approaches is it does seem like there's some things that cows don't, like they shouldn't really eat, especially green.
Normally things that are very like leafy and green haven't like died down at all. They have trouble processing. I don't understand it enough either to really like delve into it. But look, for instance, one of the things that we've done in the past is, you know, swathed our last cutting of alfalfa and turned some cows out onto that, and it hasn't gone as well. And so just knowing that there's that risk, we're not confident enough yet in it to try that in very like constrained areas. Now if they have other, you know, options for food and it's a larger area and there's some dry material, we would probably try it. But we, again, like cows are cows and you still have to put up a good electric fence and make sure they have water, and there's a lot of work that goes into it. So yeah. Would love to look into it though in the future if there's options.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you guys already kind of, I mean, integrated, you know, having both crops and livestock, and you're already not going on vacation real often. So, you know, I was just wondering if you were getting on that exploration or not. No, that's great. So I guess let's circle back to when you try something, how do you know if it's a success or something you might want to try again the next year?
I think like, aside from dad just knowing, in my opinion, I think the theory of cover crop is really good. And I think that, again, it's not something that's going to just like instantly change things. I think you have to keep doing it a lot of times in order to see good results. And so I think that's kind of what we keep going back to it. Like we really believe that like there's something there, and like in theory, this is going to work, and we just believe in that. And so we want to keep trying it long enough to determine whether or not like we are making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you don't go whole hog either, I mean, you know, where I'm doing 5, 10, 15 acres, you know, what I look at, did it hurt us in any way financially? You know, did that really make a big difference on the yield of that field? You know, and arguably, probably, you know, but in the long term, it'll make a difference in the other way because organic matter. So in that 1 year, it's like, yeah, we might have taken a little bath on those 5 acres, you know, maybe. But it didn't, you know, it didn't hurt us in a way that we're going into bankruptcy. You don't want to get to that point, obviously. But small little plots and small experiments makes it a lot easier.
Can you talk a little bit about your placements? How do you keep track of it? How do you put it out and manage that within your normal farming operations? Like, do you want to talk a little bit more about that aspect of trying things on the farm?
Well, I think my daughter would say if I'd take better notes and do a journal, we could keep better track of it.
It's all up here.
It's all up here, dear. Don't worry about it.
I would answer that by saying that we like just know what our on-risk tills are and like what pieces we're really working to improve. And so when the rotation allows for the chem follow, we have that field in chem follow, and we're like, okay, this is, we don't have a cash crop on there. This is the year that we're going to take that hilltop and we're going to do cover crop there, or we're going to, you know, do residue redistribution there or whatever. So it's not really like, year over year, we're like necessarily being like, okay, this is our focus this year, but it's like, okay, well, this is in chem follow this year, so this year our focus is on those hilltops, and that's kind of what makes the decision for us.
Thanks. I'm just always curious how people are making their trials work you know, as part of the working farm, because mm-hmm. I know that comes with a lot of its own challenges, just in the workflow. Or, but it sounds like maybe with the compost, does the timing, you know, do you have more flexibility on it? It's not something that necessarily has to happen during harvest or during seeding. It's like maybe you can kind of get to that when you get to it.
It's still a timing issue because if you're borrowing that spreader, he wants it back. You know, you can't sit on it for a month.
Don't want to make Scott mad at you.
No. So we get it, you know, on site, and a week later, he's like, are you done with it? And it's like, dude, we had 400 tons of freaking, or, you know, how many? A lot. And, you know, not every day is a spread day, you know.
It rains in the fall.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or it freezes, or it snows. This next year, we're going to be getting compost in the spring and putting it on in the summer rather than in the fall. So we'll see how that works in with everything. I'm not going to say we have just all kinds of time in the summer because we have cows and hay, but the weather should be good enough to where we're not sliding off of hills, you know, that sort of thing. And we should have a little bit more window to put it on. I don't think that's Scott's busiest time with his spreader. I'm not sure. And we're always looking to buy one too. If we can get the right funding to get one purchased and just have it in the area to use with people that want to do it.
Do you work a lot with the conservation district?
They know where I am. Yeah. I've worked, it hasn't come to fruition. It might this year, maybe.
Yeah. Have you done other projects with the conservation district?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We've done, Steven's coming tomorrow to look at some offsite watering projects that I'd like to do. Pretty heavily involved in CSP, which is a big one.
Well, that's the NRCS, and I hear the Rock Lake Conservation District has a pretty fun and exciting history. Wasn't Dan Harwood?
Yeah, he was the manager for years. Yeah,
he's a good legacy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's always an asset. It's always fun when he stops by and we start talking about things. Uh-huh. So he knows me, you know, quite well. Yeah, it's a good egg. When I started doing that, the spreading the straw and stuff, and some people were, I should say most people were like, that's crazy, you know, but that means it might be a good idea.
I agree with you.
The more people say you're off your rocker, you're thinking, well, maybe not, you know.
So you kind of already spoke to, do you have things you've tried in the recent past that you're trying again this year to see if it has a similar outcome? Do you want to expand on anything there?
So we're involved in the U of I cover cropping experiment, and then we're also involved in one that the Palouse Conservation District is sponsoring or putting on. And that one we really focused on pasture cover crop. And so we're going to be trying that again because last year it didn't quite go the way that we wanted it to, but we also had a lack of moisture, so that could have been why. So we're just kind of choosing several little spots out there that have like really shallow soil or not growing a lot of grass, or do grow grass on years that there's a lot of moisture and then tend to not grow very much in years like last year. And so we put out a cover crop mix that had like some clovers and some triticale and had millet, had mm-hmm. peas in it, I think. Mm-hmm. Things that we thought would be good forages for cattle that might take root and then come back the next year, and we could just kind of, you know, build on them to improve like these pasture areas. So we're gonna try that again and hopefully see better results. But you're also doing the U of I thing again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We got several more experiments, and I said the compost thing is going to happen again this year, and we'll just figure out how to get that done.
Awesome. Yeah, you guys are up to some really fun stuff. So let's do like a bit of a lightning round here as we wrap up.
Okay.
What's the most fun thing about trying new stuff on your farm?
You go first.
The neighbors' reactions.
So you're up with the experiment right out on the road.
I'm totally
guy.
Fine with that. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't want to hide it. I want to hide the seed skip because that's just my bad. The spray skip. But, you know, when I'm doing something weird and different, I pretty much like to have it front and center.
Mm-hmm. This podcast should help with that too.
Oh, I'm sure.
Make sure you recommend it. Tell your neighbors. Yeah. How about you, Erin?
I think it's just interesting to, like, see what happens, you know? Because I think that something always happens that you're not expecting. Either, like, you know, it doesn't work out the way that you wanted, and you're like, okay, well, what happened there? Or, you know, it just does something interesting that you weren't expecting, and you're like, oh, that's cool. Let's see if we can make that happen again. I don't know. I think it's exciting to just talk about and figure out what's going on out there.
Yeah, it's an adventure and curiosity.
Yeah.
What's the most annoying thing about trying new stuff on the farm?
The neighbors' reactions. No, it's the time. Oh. It takes a lot of time to do those things. And, you know, you'd rather be going on vacation or spending family time or going golfing, you know, anything that everybody else has got their seeds in the ground and we're still trying to amend soil, you know. So a time constraint.
Yeah. I'd have to second that. Yeah. And you think you're done and then you're like, oh, yeah, never mind. We're not done yet. We still have, you know, a whole bag of cover crop seed to put in the ground.
But it's, I mean, you're already getting family time. You know, you throw.
Oh, every day is family time. That's
true. You know, you tell your kiddo, like, we're doing this for you.
I'm not sure she appreciates it yet.
Hopefully she'll get there. Did she have a good toy tractor to play with?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. Right there,
yeah. Excellent. That's important. Maybe don't have her pick rocks just yet.
Yeah. Soon.
Okay, if you could ask a scientist a question, what would it be?
Tracy will laugh because I'm curious about soybeans in this area. And he's going to dabble in them yet again.
I thought he was retired.
Well, he'll make his kids dabble. And they'll be like, oh my God. But I would be very curious to see beans be something in this area. And that's a scientific thing. How do we grow a plant that will work in this climate, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know this isn't really ask a scientist, but there's new things coming down about biofuel. And what I've read anyway is going to mean an awful lot more acres of both soybeans and canola needed for the oil. So that's very exciting.
New crops, kind of always having an eye on what might be a viable addition to the rotation is an interesting question to me, at least. It's fun to mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, I think beans would be easy to cut, and I think they'd be easy to seed back into, you know, from what I can see. I've never cut them. Sorry, guys, maybe it's hard.
It's farming, it probably is.
Yeah.
So I imagine they probably wouldn't have a lot of residue to stick around. So there might be a little bit of, you know, balance to be found there in the rotation.
When they're normally on a 30-inch row, maybe that's not an option here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where we're trying to do 7, 8, 10-inch rows, that's quite a bit of room in between stalks that's just bare ground. So it makes no-tilling quite a bit easier.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Erin? If you could ask a scientist a question.
I don't know if it's really a question, but it's just something that I roll around in my mind all the time. It's like, how do you make water not the limiting factor for, like, growing cover crops and then your cash crop? Because what I've seen in growing hay is that, in irrigated hay specifically, is that when you have a lot of cover and the ground is shaded, you seem to have an abundance of water there because the ground is shaded and it's not evaporating. So in theory, when your cover crop is, like, all leafed out, you should be shading the ground and therefore retaining the moisture. Yet it always seems to be that when you terminate the cover crop and then go to seed your cash crop into it, the moisture is gone. So how do we stopgap that is what I want to try and figure out.
That's a really interesting question. I appreciate that. So how do you think things will be different when it's your kids' turn to farm? We'll start with Doug.
Well, that's
kind of, how do you
things
think...
Things are the way they are right now. What
do you
mean?
Wait a second, sorry. How do you see the changes in ag affecting how your kids might farm throughout their career?
You could even just start with, like, how it's changed since
technology. Yeah, it's the technology that's going to be the big factor. And just, you know, the number of acres you can get over anymore with more horsepower and bigger combines and everything, you know. And so with more acres means more work. But if the work is less because you can do twice as much and more family time, perhaps more, except for you're going to be experimenting with cover crops. You know, you don't have any time for that.
We're getting your drill clogged with compost pearls.
I think technology has changed a ton since I started, you know. I can't take advantage of all that new tech because it's just on my size. We just can't afford it. But there's a lot of new stuff out there. Maybe when you hit the lottery, you can buy all that neat tech.
Oh, if she does hit the lottery, what do you think she should get? It's like the aspirational thing.
Well, I think everybody would say, "I want the new combine." You know, I don't know what. That wouldn't be my choice.
Well, the thing about the lottery I've heard is you have to play to win.
That's what they keep telling me. That's so unfair.
So like a self-propelled combine that drives up the hills themselves.
Oh, you're talking real tech.
I would eliminate just think, the evil Knievel.
I was just thinking something less than, you know, 25 years old would be a nice upgrade.
And how about you? How do you see ag evolving throughout your career? And, you know, again, once someday your daughter grows up and wants to be a farmer like her mom.
I guess I have 2 points on this. One thing that I think is really cool is I didn't have a lot of female role models in ag when I was a kid. And now just like the amount of girls and women actually that I know that I've come back to farm and are farming with their dads and stuff, I think that will be really cool for my daughter to see, is that there are, you know, several of us out here doing this. So I think that's one way that it's changing. I think another thing that's changing that I think is really cool and exciting is just like eggs outreach. I think there's a lot of people who recognize that like consumers are pretty out of touch with where their food is coming from and how important it is to consumers to like actually know who's producing their food and where it's coming from and try to have it be local if possible. And so I think that's something that's really going to, you know, continue and grow in egg in my lifetime. And so just to like try and be a part of that as much as possible, I think is, you know, in everyone's best interest and is just really good for like communities and people by and large. So
ooh, I'm so excited for, you know, maybe the Women in Ag peer-to-peer network and the robust regional food systems. Awesome. I just want to give you guys a big thanks for being up for sharing your experiences. It sounds like you've had some really fun on-farm trials and sharing a bit about your experience in farm succession and yeah, just really appreciate you having me out today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies. Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.